Welcome to episode one of this second series of Kind to Your Mind. This time it's my great pleasure to welcome Annika Anura and Amika Anura to the podcast, because in this episode, as we're in Black History Month, we want to focus on the mental health of this community. Annika is a hugely successful athlete. She made her Olympic debut at London 2012, competing in the 100 metres and 200 metres, and in 2015 won 4x400 metre relay bronze at the World Championships in Beijing, before adding European 4x400 metre relay gold and 400 metres bronze to her collection the following year. Joining us is her brother, Amika Anura, who is a writer, journalist and lecturer on issues of racism and ethnicity in sport, and author of Pitch Black, The History of Black British Footballers. First of all, Annika, can you tell us about your experiences in order to get there? How was it growing up in Liverpool and getting to where you got, right to the very top of your sport?
Yeah, it was definitely a struggle, to say the least. I think when you look at most professional athletes' transitions through the years in elite sport, everyone's journey is different, and it's never ever a straight line. It's always, you know, peaks and troughs and a lot of ups and downs. But yeah, in the beginning it was definitely a struggle to begin with. Being from Liverpool, I didn't really have, in the Liverpool Black community, it was great, but I guess when I started training at Wavertree Athletics Club with Liverpool Harriers, there wasn't that many female role models around at the time, elite athletes especially. I think the only one at the time was a female athlete called Diane Allegreen. Now, thankfully, I had Diane as a massive inspiration to me, mainly for two reasons. One, because she went to my secondary school, Officer Blanche, so I basically broke and killed all her school records. And then secondly, because she went on to compete at the Olympic Games, and she's, you know, Black, strong, female, you know, she's stronger, she's so powerful, and she's stunning as well, she's absolutely beautiful. And it was great to have, you know, amazing role models like her who didn't look too far from me. So I think I was thankful looking back. I'm always thankful looking back from having the likes of Diane as a huge role model growing up. And then, you know, ironically, later on, we then went on to compete at the same championships together. And just having people like her around, and then other athletes as well, when you go on to compete in the teams, was great, you know, being inspired by their journeys. But throughout the years, it wasn't easy. You know, I went uni and had to work several jobs. There's a massive misconception, I think, where athletes are given this, you know, the streets are paved with gold and you're getting, you know, funding and shoe contract and endorsements and all of that. I didn't get my first shoe contract till I was 21. And at that point, I'd already been in the sport around six, seven years. So I wasn't a very, very good junior at all. I was okay. But I think my senior years, I definitely started to show, you know, signs of potential. And then over the years, once I competed at senior level, I started being successful, winning medals, change events along the way, went to three Olympics and finally got my Olympic medal.
So you got right to the very top, and people do develop at different rates, don't they? But did you find that things weren't necessarily quite so easy because of your background? Did you feel that you were having to do it sort of the hard way in some ways versus maybe some of the other people, some of your peers?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think definitely looking back now, I think I do a lot of that reminiscing on certain things that you think, well, why did that happen? And you know, this occurred at this point in my career and just little things like that. You know, for example, you know, when you're a sprinter coming through, especially a Black sprinter, you're already seen as a dominant force, especially in your event. So you have to fight in order to be seen and to be seen as like one of the best and different from everyone else. Like, what makes you stand out? Why should, you know, the Federation give you funding? Why should you be getting these endorsements from Nike or Adidas or New Balance or whoever? Whereas when a white sprinter comes along, for example, and they have one great successful year, you know, no disrespect to them, but they're given shoe contracts and all the plaudits after one great year, whereas the rest of us have had to fight continuously year after year after year. And, you know, it's always that cliche as well, which the media also, you know, I think they play a huge part in, you know, deeming it, in air quotes, the great white hope. So sometimes it was very frustrating at times, extremely frustrating, because you're doing the exact same thing as them, whereas they're deemed as different just because of the colour of their skin, and they're given all these endorsements and magazine deals and all of this, whereas the rest of us are just kind of being left behind. So when I look back on moments like that, it was definitely disheartening to see. And also as well, I think when it comes, like, going back to what I was saying previously in the last question regarding role models, you know, I didn't really see that many black sportswomen on the front cover of magazines, newspaper, media articles. So it was a case where it was always, when it came to what we'd see, it would always be like a white girl doing the representation for a Nike ad or an Adidas ad, or, you know, someone who's of a fairer skin colour. Whereas I never saw any black girls on any magazines or the front cover of, like, even like Cosmopolitan or Elle or Vogue or any of those magazines. I think it's just now we're starting to see the likes of Serena Williams and Dina Asher-Smith and Simone Biles. And I think it's definitely great to see. I think it's amazing to see, because you can't be what you can't see. And that's why I always believe that representation is important, because it's prevalent that these young girls see women who look like them on a day-to-day basis in, you know, in spaces of media.
Sure. And at this point, I'd like to bring in another guest who's with us, and it's your brother. It's Emeka Onwuah. Welcome along to the Kind to Your Mind podcast, Emmy.
Nice to be here, and thanks for having me on the program.
To talk about your experience, I mentioned that you're a sporting family. I remember too seeing your brother Ife. Ife used to play. In my experience, he was playing for Huddersfield Town, and he was a great player. If I had to name one of the players of that era, I'm thinking talking about 1991 or something, I think he would be the only one I could actually name.
Right.
Because he was a hugely successful footballer at the time. So sport runs very much firmly in your family. You've written a book called Pitch Black, The Story of Black British Footballers. I mean, start by telling us about that book and maybe some of the things that you found through writing that book as well.
The book's kind of set, or, you know, takes a kind of historical perspective of trying to chart the rise of black footballers, mainly from the 1970s up to the present day. There have been black footballers throughout the history of professional football in this country. In fact, the first professional footballer was a guy called Arthur Wharton, who was quite an accomplished athlete, could run 100 metres in under 11 seconds, but he also played in goal for Preston North End. And he's kind of seen as the first professional footballer. But what I wanted to do was look at the point at which, from the 1970s onwards, where black footballers stopped being a novelty and became more embedded as part and parcel of the game. And most teams began to have one or more black footballers, and they weren't such a novelty. And what I wanted to discuss really in the book was the trials and tribulations that enabled them to face racism that they suffered. Most well known is kind of the terrorist racism they suffered, but also from fellow teammates, from coaching staff, and opposition players. So I wanted to kind of relate their experiences and just talk about those, and actually, in some ways, challenge the myth that actually everything today is all good, and the racism that occurred in football is something of is something that's a piece of history. It has no relevance to today, and that you know, football's a kind of cosmopolitan, inclusive melting pot where everybody gets on with everybody, and there are no racial tensions. And what I wanted to do was challenge some of that, but also acknowledge the journey that's been had for many of the kind of key figures involved.
I mean, I think exactly what you're saying, it hits the nail on the head. I think that, you know, football has definitely improved in some ways, but is a long way further back than where perhaps it was is perceived to be. I mean, we heard there was an interview a few weeks ago with, I think it was Chris Kamara, where he was detailing, you know, some of the things that he had to put up with and his family growing up in, I think it was Middlesbrough. where he was growing up, and you know, some of the abuse he got from neighbours, from people in the street, from people in the town. There was just so many more obstacles to overcome in everyday life, not just in football. I mean, what were some of the standout stories that you've uncovered through doing this that people have had to endure?
Interestingly enough, if you played football in the 70s, 80s and the 90s, I think just about everybody it spoke to at some point would have received some kind of death threat. It would have been a letter through the post, usually a letter through the post that was sent to their clubs. So every footballer I spoke to at some point had a death threat for, you know, usually an anonymous letter that went to the club. Cyril Regis very famously received a letter with a bullet in it, which told him that if he set foot on the Wembley turf in an England kit, he would be shot. And various other footballers at many times, you know, would have received death threats. So that was a common experience of all of them, actually, throughout that whole period. I suppose most moving example, worst example, was what happened to Paul Cannavale, who was the first black player to play for Chelsea. He made his debut at the age of 19. On his debut, he was racially abused by his own supporters. Every time his name was announced by, you know, pre-game, there'd be an announcement to the teams. Whenever his name was announced, he would be booed and abused by his own supporters. He received quite a few death threats as well. He scored an equaliser against West London rivals Fulham. They said his goal didn't count. He received no support from his club, and he received very little support from teammates until a trickle of black players began to kind of come through. So his story, extreme as it is, but it's kind of a microcosm of the experiences of just about all the footballers who we had. You know, I remember George Berry had told me, he's a former kind of Stoke and Wolves player, told me about a time he'd gone to a certain club. They'd be spat on or they'd be physically challenged by a group of National Front. So they really did go through some kind of quite harrowing times. And for the most part, the clubs kind of didn't do anything about it. They didn't see that they had a duty of care to support an employee. And so they were kind of some of the stories that emerged from the book I wrote.
Harrowing stories there of what people are having to face purely based on the colour of their skin. Annika, do those stories translate through to athletics too?
Yeah, I mean, football definitely is far worse, I think, in athletics. Because our sport is seen as very diverse, people assume that racism is something that we don't encounter. Whereas we suffer the same as, you know, people, as anyone on a daily basis. It's just hidden away, you know, it's systematic. It's the small microaggressions that you have. Like when I'd walk into a training centre, and when I was based up in the East Midlands, for example, I was based at a high performance centre there for a long time, and I never really saw people who looked like me. There was a couple of girls who were there, but most of the sprinters, for example, were based in London. A lot of them were London-based, so it was only every so often you'd see someone, another female black sprinter, who'd come up. Whereas when I'd go upstairs, like within the, you know, the team staff room, you'd see all the leaders and everyone is white. So when I had, you know, an issue to do with like, oh, well, this doesn't make me feel comfortable, the only person I'd go and speak to really who was, you know, who's phenomenal anyway, her name was Paula Dunn and she's the Paralympic head coach. So I'd known Paula for years. She used to look after my workouts back when she lived in Manchester. She was one of the EIS high performance coaches there. And then she's moved up the ranks over the years and is now the Paralympic head coach. But Paula was always the anomaly because there was no one else who looked like Paula. And for a sport that's dominated by black athletes, and that's where all the medals come from, all the medals or majority of the medals that keep the sport moving is from the black athletes. So it's such a shame to see that we're now having these discussions where they now have to be forced to look at themselves. You know, organisations like British Athletics, like, you know, the FA, like England Hockey and England Netball, they do have to look at the leadership roles that are available and give them out to, you know, contenders within the BAME community, I think it's important that you do see that, because you can't just expect all the athletes to do all the work and basically eat off the athletes. So in doing so, we are being exploited. But then you don't see any leadership from people who look like you. So I'm glad that these conversations are being had. And I'm glad that athletes, not just in athletics and other sports, but everyone globally is speaking up.
Can I just add to that as well? Because what's important to realize is that most of these athletes are have dedicated their kind of whole lives to the sport, quite often at the detriment of their educational studies. So growing up, Annie would have lost out on opportunities to take part in other activities with friends, and so on and so forth. And for many footballers, for many young footballers who were picked up by academies at the age of 6 or 7, in many cases, they require total dedication to their footballing endeavours, quite often at the detriment of their education. Then what happens is, as they're discarded, they can either discard because they're not good enough, or through injury, or for a variety of reasons, then they're not allowed opportunities to stay within the only industry that they're familiar with and that they know. And so that can have a massive impact on them, because they're ill-equipped once they finish sport. They're ill-equipped for the day-to-day challenges of trying to carve a life outside of sport. I mean, don't forget, retirement is, retirement in your, I mean, if you're lucky enough like Annie, who is able to retire in their 30s, then even at the age of 30, you're still a young person. And so you still face 30, 40 years of a working life, and you've sacrificed for a relatively short period of time. You made enormous kind of personal sacrifices for your sport for a long period of time. And I think it's incumbent upon all sports to enable its athletes, all athletes, to have opportunities to stay in the sport and contribute to the development of the sport in the best way that they can.
We've seen the Queen's Birthday Honours, and people such as Marcus Rashford have been leading lights on various issues, and he's received an MBE. Is that a sign that society is listening more to black athletes?
What's really interesting is actually that if you take a kind of historical perspective, that athletes being involved in activism has been a feature of sport for over 100 years. If you think back to 1908, the first black heavyweight champion was a guy called Jack Johnson. He wasn't allowed to fight for the world heavyweight title until he had to basically beat all comers almost twice in order to do it. And he was the first heavyweight champion. And he spoke out a lot about his condition and his situation. In America, you have people like Jackie Robinson, who broke the color bar in Major League Baseball. And obviously in the 68 Olympics, there's that iconic image of John Carlos and Tommy Smith giving a Black Power salute, as well as people like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Muhammad Ali, who were also activists. So this tradition, so what we're facing now is a kind of long tradition of athlete activism. So it doesn't necessarily mean that because there's been a long tradition of it, that things are necessarily changing for the better. So I think in the future, unless things change, athletes will always feel the need to speak out on various kind of social justice issues.
It's something that has been going on for such a long time, like over 100 years. It's not something that's seen as new now. I just think honestly, because of COVID and because of the way the landscape of the things have just changed this year, people have had to just take a step back and realise, like, this is actually what's been going on with black people for years. You know, you have moments where, I mean, I've been told people just end up gaslighting me, thinking, you know, telling me this isn't real, this isn't happening. Oh, you know, we're all treated as equal. And it's like, wait, so every black person who speaks up against racism, we're all lying. Every single one of us. It's ridiculous.
When you've come up against racism, as you've mentioned, and things like that. How has that played on your mental health, and what have your coping mechanisms been when you've had to face up to that, particularly, you know, leading up to, you know, competitions and around competitions?
I think it was just a case of, unfortunately, having to block a lot of things out, just block all the negativity out. And I know it's very cliche, but I think having spoken to a lot of my teammates, especially the black athletes, I shouldn't laugh about this, but I think as black people, we just always tend to compartmentalize everything. And it's tough. It does get tough. You know, we can't speak freely about these situations because it's something that maybe a white teammate or someone who's white in the leadership role, a senior management role, can't relate to. So they don't know how to deal with the situation. I think one of the things that helped me throughout the years when I'd come up with things like that was definitely speaking to it with family and friends. Obviously, Emmy, in case you didn't know, he's a massive help. He's always been a massive, massive help to me from day one, as have the rest of my family as well. But also speaking to other athletes about these situations. I think now, because of everything that's happened this year, you know, just being, you know, just shocked by, you know, the deaths that happened with Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, you realise that you could see that in you. You know, that could be any one of us as black people. We can all relate to that situation. It can be something as trivial as, you know, being stopped by the police and having to deal with those situations where you know why you're getting stopped and it has nothing to do with your car. Like, I was stopped on countless times, both in Liverpool and having lived in London. And it's not like I was driving a flashy car. You're just being stopped by the police and they'd ask you the same questions. And one of the things I always remember over the years, well, from such a young age, my dad always told me, like, when the police stop you, just comply, always comply. And it's like, well, why should we have to comply when they're the ones who are stopping us based off the colour of your race? But I remember him always saying, like, it was one of those things where I don't want to get a phone call saying that the police have arrested you or the police have, you know, caused harm to you. You know, it's just one of those things that I think as a parent, you fall into, you become fearful of what the police can actually do. So being told that from such a young age, I don't think white people are told the exact same thing, you know. So again, moving forward over the years in sport, it's just, you know, the microaggressions and all of these things that kind of play up to what we have to deal with on a daily basis. So definitely speaking to other people around it, having a great psychologist also helped throughout the years. And I guess now moving forward, just expressing our feelings without feeling the need to, without feeling like, you know, it's going to be a detriment. Because having written that article for the Huffington Post, it's opened a lot of discussions within sport, and various people have contacted me regarding the things that I went through. So yeah, it's been great, but I definitely encourage other people to just be open and discuss this, because we can't hold back on everything for the rest of our lives. We have to have a space to just speak freely.
I think just to add to that, one of the things that society does for athletes as well as other people is shuts down any kind of conversation and any expression that you might have received racist behavior towards you. There's a denial, and there's a need for black athletes, and not just black athletes, but as we're talking about athletes, there's a famous quote about you know, when Colin Kaepernick took a knee. And Fox News reporter said, "Don't talk, just dribble." In other words, stop talking about racism. We pay you to be an athlete. We pay you to play a sport. We don't want to hear you whining about all this other stuff. You're a well-paid athlete. Stop complaining. And one of the impacts that has on black athletes is that they're not allowed to talk about things that affect them and affect them deeply. And that has an impact on your mental health. I mean, all athletes, for example, I remember, you know, periods of time when Annie was injured was really struggle. She would really struggle with injuries. You know, being out, not being able to train, not being able to compete, wondering how, in what state you're kind of going to be back. Injuries are a factor for all athletes, absolutely. But for many athletes who, like Annie, don't come from a background where you know, the parents have got the finances to kind of help them when things go bad. It impacts upon the whether they're going to be on funding, whether they lose the funding that will enable them to train properly and compete well, and all of those kind of things. I think for black athletes, shutting down the opportunity for them to share their experiences and to discuss issues of racism, and that's a systematic problem within the country, also has an impact on their mental health. And so obviously black athletes will share with other black athletes their experiences, and that helps in some ways to deal with things, and it helps, as Annie said, to kind of compartmentalize things. The other thing as well is that obviously one of the things you can't do as a black person, you can't fight every single battle in exactly the same way, and there are things that you do have to just kind of let go and not address because you don't have the time, or you don't have the energy, or you don't feel that by actually challenging something, anything's going to happen. And we've seen as well, lots of times when people do challenge racism, they're always painted as the aggressor, or speaking out. Actually, there's always a backlash whenever you speak out. And all of these things really do impact upon black athletes in particular.
One thing that we've seen, with certainly specific to football, and we hear about that things are changing. But yeah, as of, I think, at the start of this season, which has just begun, I'm not sure exactly what the figure is now, but I don't think it's going to be wildly different, that out of all of the 92 league club managers, I think we only have 6 or 7 who are from a black or a black ethnic minority background. I mean, that's obviously indicative of some part of the problem, isn't it, in certainly in British football. But does that sort of situation expand out to other sports as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And what you find is that in football, I think they're up to 5 managers at the moment. Chris Hughton was appointed last week to be Nottingham Forest manager, and I think they may be up to 5. I might not have the figures wrong, but the figure you quote was 6 or 7 is about right, and has remained between 3 and 7 for a good 20 years, 20, 25 years. It's always been round about that figure. I remember when people first started talking about this issue, that they were told, well, hang on, don't complain, your time will come. In 5 or 10 years' time, there will be more black managers coming through and everything else. And now, here we are, 20-odd years later, still having the exact same conversation and still having the exact same excuses being levelled. I think in football, and it's very similar to athletics, football and athletics and perhaps boxing are probably the sports in this country where black people are kind of allowed to dominate, and there are specifically good cultural and economic reasons for that. Actually, most of those sports don't necessarily cost a lot, although athletics is quite expensive. But most of those sports don't necessarily cost a lot. And the other thing you do have is a lot of role models. So there are always people who you can emulate, even if we have to find them from Jamaica or the States. But the point I wanted to make was that in football, 25 to 30% of footballers are from a minority ethnic background. Yet they're not allowed to kind of stay in the sport. And this is one of the things I was mentioning earlier. They're not being given the opportunities to stay in the sport and become coaches or administrators or anything. So what you find is, and it's quite, and where it gets even more relevant is maybe at academy level. Lots of those academies are filled with young black kids from poor backgrounds. And the message it says to them is, It's okay for you to play, but beyond playing, we have no use for you. And so it doesn't give people the idea that the sport is something that you can stay in. If you work hard, you get your qualifications, you're innovative, you've got good ideas, you've got good strategies, you've got good tactics, and you're good with people. It doesn't give those people who want to stay in the sport beyond playing the incentive, because the message that the sports tells you is that once you stop playing, there are no more opportunities for you. in coaching or administration or managerial level. And I think that's a real problem.
Definitely the same in athletics. You know, over the years that I've been in the sport, I never saw hardly any black leadership within British athletics. The coaches that they had were black, but the black coaches I saw were definitely treated differently to the white counterparts. And they were always given I feel like the white coaches were always fast-tracked to bigger and better roles. You know, within 2-3 years, you'd have them in a senior management role. Whereas the black coaches were either, again, told, oh, just wait your turn, or, you know, you're doing okay, but we want you to do this, or they give their role to someone else. Whereas now, what we're seeing, which has been a dramatic turn of events this year, especially Christian Malcolm, who was a British athlete, my former teammate as well. He was a sprinter for Great Britain, a 100, 200 sprinter, world-class athlete. And he was the head coach. He was the sprint coach for a number of years for the relay team between 2015 and 2017. And he helped the team to Olympic success, got the men's and women's team Olympic medals, made the guys world champions, helped with the success of the guys' team in world championships to 2017. And then post-2017, he was given a role within Australian athletics as a performance consultant. And when British athletics, when he told British athletics, they were like, yeah, that's fine. You know, it's fine for you to go to Australia. Whereas in my mind, they should never have let him go, because fast forward 2 years later, because he couldn't get a role within British athletics that would see him progress over the years, he's now been brought back as the head coach of the Olympic team. You know, so I think it's just very telling how the opportunities are given and who they're given to and whose face fits. But I'm glad now that, to be honest, a lot of the old faces and a lot of the older people within the sport who run the sport are now gone and they're now going. And we're starting to see some fresh people, because they bring different perspectives and different ideas and also great leadership. Like Christian Malcolm is a leader. He's been a leader since day one. So I think with his new role, he won't have any problems in, you know, with the athletes warming to him. So I'm excited to see how he gets on over the next couple of years.
Emmy, if to round things off for you, I mean, if you could suggest one strategy or action for the sports industry as a whole to introduce to support the mental health of black athletes, I mean, what would that be, do you think, in an ideal world if you had a magic wand?
The main thing we have to do with all athletes is to recognise and remember that these are human beings, and we have to stop commodifying them, really. They're all human beings. They all have human sensibilities. And one of the things and we put enormous pressure on them to win medals, win races, play well for the team, and everything else. And we also seem to think, and it's not the case in most sports, but there's only a few sports where there's a lot of money around. But we also seem to think that somehow magically giving somebody a lot of money is gonna will mask any mental health issues, racism, discrimination, or anything of that nature. So one of the things I would like to see us do is have a completely different attitude to the way in which we think about athletes. Don't forget, many of these athletes, as I said earlier, start their sport at a very young age. In many cases, when they're still in primary school, the educational support they get is not always very good from the industry itself. It's not always the case that they get a lot of mental health support. Mental health support isn't always discussed openly. There isn't necessarily the infrastructure there. I mean, you know, if you think about what sports federations spend on strength and conditioning and the medical support and everything else, they spend a phenomenal amount on ensuring that the athletes can get well, get back out there. A lot of time and a lot of research is put into recovery, health, best, you know, training techniques, all of those kind of things. But yet mental health is a very poor relation, and so something around that needs to be done to prepare athletes for the day that inevitably comes to all athletes, when they're no longer able to compete. and they can't be left high and dry. Disproportionate amounts of athletes suffer from things like mental health, gambling and other addictions, and so on once they retire from the sport because, you know, for a variety of reasons. Sometimes sport masks some of the mental health issues that are underlying. Sometimes it's because they're left kind of high and dry with no experiences and no qualifications to do anything else other than compete. And that's and it's difficult to manage the transition from an elite athlete into an ordinary person with 40 years left of their kind of working lives left to go.
Talking about 2020, it's sort of away, I suppose, from the track, because largely you've retired now from competitive athletics that you were doing before. But what has your lockdown experience been like, and how have you used your abilities maybe that you've learned as an athlete to bring you that mental strength to get through it, and what have your coping mechanisms been?
Honestly, there's been different things that I've kind of been doing, I guess, since I've retired. So I've been doing some business consultancy work. So in the beginning, I was supposed to work, bit of background. So I studied economics at university, and I then wanted to move into potentially doing that, you know, once I've retired. There was a lot of different opportunities that were offered to me, but there was definitely broadcasting. That was one of the things I definitely wanted to do. There was, which I'm kind of still doing at the moment, there was definitely working in finance. There was a lot of speaking opportunities, so going to schools, speaking in businesses, sharing my story with, you know, and basically anyone who'd listen, because I guess my story is kind of powerful, you know, kind of how things have worked out over the years in sport. And then one of the things that I've also been doing as well is, I guess you don't hear very often, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you don't hear many Scouse people on TV, like be it in radio or adverts or whatever. So I'm actually moving into voiceover work as well, which is really, really interesting. And I've really, really been enjoying it. So it's been tough, as I'm sure the industry is. But if I've learned anything about being resilient over the years in sport, I can literally plow my way through anything that anyone tells me to do. Obviously, while taking rest and give myself a break. And also, you know, I always tell people, because I definitely didn't do much of that when I was competing, but definitely working on taking care of your mental health. And it's okay to say no. Also, to add, I've been saying no a lot more this year than I think I've ever done my whole career. I think before, every time I was doing something or asked to do something, it was always yes, 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 that's fine. No, no worries, no problem. Da, 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 da. Whereas now I'm like, I'm okay, you know, just to say no. Like, can I say no to this? Yeah, I'm going to say no. And I don't even give it a second thought, because I think I'm just so used to just compartmentalizing everything and just keeping it within and not really looking after my mental health, because we do actually go through a lot as elite athletes. So that's why it's important that I think we do need to take care of ourselves post, you know, post track and field or post sport in life.
And finally, similar to what I said to Emmy, I suppose, if you had a magic wand or a great hope for how things would be, let's say 10 years from now, I mean, how would the world look for a black athlete as yourself? And we've talked about all the things that you've gone through. I mean, if things were to improve, if you had your way, I mean, what would be the key differences that you would change?
There's a few. So one of the key differences I would love to see more black leaders within sport and within business and just within society as a whole, and not necessarily people saying, oh, well, this is seen as a token gesture or it's a tick box. You know, that's not what we want to see. We want to see people who look like ourselves. Like I've been saying, like Emmy was saying, representation is important, but you know, the stats and the statistics do not lie. How many roles, like Emmy was saying, had been given to black footballers compared to some of the white counterparts who have been fast-tracked into these big, you know, premiership roles, you know, these Division One roles, the championship roles, you know, these big, big jobs that are given to them. Whereas, you know, some of the black footballers have to start from the Conference League or Division 3, which is ridiculous. So that's why it's important to see, like I was saying, the likes of Christian Malcolm, who are being given these big, big roles. He should have been given that role many years ago. He has the credentials. He has the experience. He's a great leader. So I hope we can see more of that, not just in sport, but in society as a whole. I want to see a lot of that. And it's great that now, like I was saying, a lot of people are speaking up. There's a lot more roles that are becoming available. You know, everything's moving a lot more digital with the things that we're seeing in society now, especially with lockdown and things that have, you know, had to come to a halt. So moving forward, I definitely want to see a lot more change within sport, and hopefully it will happen. I definitely believe it can. And people like myself who are continuing to speak out about, you know, the discrimination and the racism, and just opening people's eyes to what they've seen in the past and what and how things need to change in the future is a huge starting point. So I definitely hope that these changes are moving forward in order for us to progress as a society.
Annika, Emmy, it's been great speaking with you, and thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to Annika Onora and Emeka Onora, our guests on Kind to Your Mind. Brought to you by your local councils and the NHS in Cheshire and Merseyside. Remember to hit subscribe and give us a rating. We also love to hear from you too, so feel free to leave a comment. For more information about Kind to Your Mind, visit kindtoyourmind.org, where you'll find lots of helpful information and resources, including top tips from the Every Mind Matters campaign and ALMA, an online wellbeing portal for those living and working in Cheshire and Merseyside. That's it for now. See you next time. Goodbye.